Thank you, Marty. Right, I'll try to give you a bit of an impression of the kinds of objects we're thinking about and the kinds of problems associated with them, and solve theoretical problems. It's called disks and jets. And by disks, we mean accretion disks, is a term that I'll explain a little bit later. By jets, we mean a fairly collimated outflow of mass from a celestial object. It is fairly general, and the reason is that we see these things in a wide variety of different kinds of astrophysical objects. Now, the jets part of it is easy to show. I would like to show you a few images. Astronomers like to show images of the things that they see in the sky, and the public likes to see these images. This is a very beneficial arrangement. So, let me show you. Turn on the light a little bit. This is a very nice case of a galaxy that produces outflows. You don't see the galaxy here at the center. These are two different scales. This is on a large scale, and this is the inner part of that outflow. The galaxy is somewhere in here, and these outflows that you see coming out here are, these are images in the radio. Most of the emission, they're most clearly seen in the radio wavelengths. The galaxy 3C 31, one of the
best. What sort of spatial scale is that?
This would be now, say, a few hundred kiloparsecs or so. And this is maybe tens of kiloparsecs.
Is the curly, is it going to be caused by precession of the source?
Well, that's an interesting question. I explicitly decided that this case, because it looks more like, this, it looks a bit like the kind of plume that you would have of a jet of dye in a fluid, for example. So the idea is that here, in this inner region, it's just a fairly ballistic kind of outflow. But at some point, it starts interacting with the environment there, and these twists may either be due to its precession or to the fact that it's moving in an environment. The whole object is moving in an environment. So this is one kind of source. It can also look much more, quite different. The two classes of exogalactic jets that one has, the first one was the type 1, and this is the type 2, where one sees a rather different kind of emissions. Again, a galaxy in the center that produces radio emission, and a thin jet coming out of it, which apparently has a large amount of kinetic energy that dissipates in these two lobes here. Here we believe that the outflow speeds are significantly higher. Relativistic outflow speeds, which make a significant amount of kinetic energy that dissipates only at the end of the source where it starts interacting with the environment. So this is, okay, let me just show you one more of this. You can look at the same source on different scales, and you'll find that this, if you blow up the image, you'll find that even at the very smallest scale that we can resolve with current technology, it's still a jet-like object. Okay, these are the so-called extragalactic sources. Oh, sorry, there's one more here. You can also see them in a visible wavelength here, for example, in the state of the AQC of the galaxy M87, with this red coming out here. And it is bluish compared to the light of the star. Another class is much closer by, 200 parsecs away from us. You see objects like this in the sky, in star-forming regions. For example, here we would have presumably a star in the process of being born here, which at the same time produces an outflow. If you look at the inner regions of it, you see this nice, almost symmetric pattern of blobs coming out from both sides of this object. So the belief is that there's something flowing out, and it has a certain modulation in it that makes these episodes of outflow show up as individual blobs moving outward.
How do you know stars being formed?
Well, I don't know this particular case. But in many cases, you can look. This is it. Infrared, the molecular hydrogen excitation. But a different wavelength, but further than the infrared, you can actually start seeing things that are hidden in here. That's typically the case, but in some cases the obscuration is so strong you can never see anything in the center. Another case here, where you see that the connections on very long scales. Here this is presumably the object that just flies out, and only at a very large distance starts interacting with its environment. And this is pretty much the only really clear case that shows a direct connection, that you directly expect to be there, or observation you also expect to be there, between what one would call a disk and a jet coming out of it. So somewhere in the center here, there's a star. You see the mass that flows into this star as it's being, as it's growing from the side. And we see an observation here due to the mass that's still on the way to the star. A disk-like object, and at the same time, a jet of mass coming out of it. Do I need to show more? No, not at this point. Let me just put this thing open. And a bit of light. So these are cases where we believe that mass is flowing into the gravitational potential of an object like a star or a black hole. At the same time, there's mass coming out. So we have apparently the case where mass is falling into a gravitational potential, but at some point in the history of its motion towards the center, it decides, changes its mind, starts flowing out. There's one of the puzzles that we'd like to address. What is it that makes this causes this connection between inflow and outflow? So what we typically, we have seen one case where we can really see it as an image. In most cases, we have to infer this from more indirect evidence. That we have an object in the center, let's call it a black hole, for example, and there's mass flowing in, which I draw from, I've seen from the side, sort of a disk-like structure rotating around the black hole like this. And it could be fed, for example, by a normal star, which transfers mass into this disk, which then spirals in, and eventually ends up in the hole. At the same time, there could be outflow, which in some way then uses this jet. This is a typical case that we see, of which we see many. An X-ray binary, for example, if this is a black hole or a neutron star, then this object uses a lot of X-rays, and it's seen as an X-ray binary. Another case could be, for example, a protostar with a large disk around it. Now the mass here is just the mass that's on the way in. There's nothing actually feeding it. That has already happened. The disk is there, and it's transferring its mass onto the star, which grows as a consequence of this. And there might be planets in the process of forming inside it, for example. And at the same time, we've seen this in our plot. And it's exactly in the stage where we believe that these planets form that we also see these outflows. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean there's a direct connection between the two, and I think, in fact, there's not the reason to believe that, but it's certainly one of the most interesting phases of evolution of a star. Now, observations that look a little bit more at the phenomenology. One sees these jets associated with disks. That's to say, in most cases, we really believe there must be an accretion disk in the object that produces the jet. But not all cases with an accretion disk also produce a jet. And in most cases where a jet is produced by a disk, it's not there all the time. Typically rather intermittent. You've seen this image of HH-12, where you see the outflow, really has this sort of intermittent structure. This appears as a very characteristic behavior of these jets, which are very intermittent, time dependent. So there is a clear connection with these disks, but we don't know exactly why it would be there, not all the time, and why it would be intermittent, for example. Just a few more properties of these jets. They can be slowish, say hundreds of kilometers per second in the protostellar case. Sub-relativistic in things we call microcraters, if the central black hole is a stellar mass black hole and product of a stellar of a massive star somewhere in our galaxy, and it can produce jets if there's a nearby star that feeds mass into it. And those outflow speeds are typically 0.2 to 0.8 C or so. And then we have the fast jets we see in AGM, like Cygnus A, which I showed, where one believes that the Lorentz factor of the outflow may be 10 or so. And if you go to the other side of the universe where we have the gamma ray bursts, we believe that gamma ray bursts also have something to do with jets. That part of it is this supernova-like phenomenon, but part of it has to do with a jet coming out of this structure, and that is what we actually see producing the gamma rays. In those cases, we believe, on somewhat indirect reasoning, that the Lorentz factors are significantly higher, maybe 100 or 300 or so. So there's a whole range of different phenomena. And different classes of objects. And at the moment, there's still sufficient uncertainty in all of this that much of the physics sort of physics in one region, a solution in one region for one kind of object can have immediate consequences for these other classes of objects as well. So that's a unifying, the theory is really sort of the process of unifying these different phenomena. One thing I just want to mention is that some of these things really do spectacular things, not just the gamma ray bursts, but for example, the sources like Cygnus A, which I showed, with these bright lobes, are also sources of very high energy photons. Some of them, if the jet happens to be beamed directly towards us, are seen in the sky as sources of photons of energies of PEVs and large, and 12 electron volts and larger. Which are photons which you can actually observe directly from your surface because of the cascade of particles that create in the atmosphere. Let me now go briefly into the mechanism that produces these jets. We'd like to know how it comes about. And after considerable, what shall I say, discussion of various possibilities, there's basically one mechanism left by elimination of others more or less, a magnetic mechanism. Like everywhere else in astrophysics, magnetic fields have their problems. They're usually much more difficult than hydrodynamics, which is already difficult in itself. There's good reason to do magnetic fields as a last resort, but there are many cases where it really is needed. And it's quite possible that jets are in fact one of those environments where we really need magnetic fields. So the model that comes out, is currently the most discussed, still the most discussed model for producing these outflows, is called magnetocentrifugal. I'm going to write it down. It arises in the presence of a magnetic field in a rotating fluid. This is, in fact, an old model. It was already proposed around the mid-70s by people like Gennady Gutenberg-Coven, who is here at the moment, and has been developed in various forms. But the basic idea is just the following. Suppose I have an object like this, a disk, with a magnetic field sticking out of it. Let's allow ourselves the freedom to make this magnetic field in a configuration that we have, that we find convenient. This is one of the difficulties, of course, finding reasons why the magnetic field would have this particular configuration, but let's, for the moment, allow ourselves this freedom. Now, most of this region is sort of vacuum. The mass is concentrated in this. This is what keeps the magnetic field lines together. The field lines are rotated around the black hole with the rotation, Kepler motion of the disk. So we then have, if I'm the black hole and this is sort of the disk here, the field lines rotate around like this. And you can probably imagine what would happen if there's mass on these field lines. Mass, gas on a field line feels no Lorentz force in the direction parallel to the magnetic field. So in the direction along the field line, the flow is completely free as if there were no magnetic field at all. It's only perpendicular to the field lines that the Lorentz forces restrict the motion. So if you imagine this as bead on a wire picture, which rotate along the current speed, and if there were beads on it here, you would see them flying off against gravity. I won't show it here. The last time I tried it, it was a bit of a disaster. the nice thing about this model is you can do all sorts of nice calculations about it. It is exosymmetric. If we allow ourselves the freedom to choose an exosymmetric field, and this is enough to produce a nice outflow. If I also allow myself the freedom to specify how much mass is on each of these field lines, I can produce a whole variety of nice outflows. There's a whole industry over the past decade that has studied these. And on the whole, one can say this is one of the great successes of MHD in astrophysics. It's one of these magnetic problems that you can do to a large extent analytically even, and it probably has direct observational relevance. It doesn't happen all that often. Typically, your magnetic fields are much more complicated, and you can't say much about them until you've done a three-dimensional simulation. But, of course, even this model also has its limitations, and at some point, real problems start coming up that require much more sophisticated, at least much more complicated, extensive kind of calculation. And I just want to mention a few of them. And in order to make that clear, let me break this problem of magnetic acceleration down into three stages. I need a new picture for this, probably not. Suppose this magnetic field is so strong that though it's anchored in the disk where it's of the same order, where its strength is in some sense of the same order as the energy in the gas, above the disk there's not much mass and that magnetic field is still of the same order, so there it completely dominates everything. So let's do a reason for this lead on a wire picture. I put a little bit of mass and it will flow out. So there's a region here between the disk and the outflow where it is decided how much mass goes on through these field lines. This is not entirely clear because the disk is cool, there's very little atmosphere above it, very little mass in it, but you need that atmosphere here to populate field lines so there will be actually outflow. So there's one problem, is the what I would call the launching problem. And this is the point where the intermittency comes in. It may be that, depending on exactly what the conditions in this region are, sometimes there is this gas that flows up and sometimes there isn't. And that has to do with the reason why sometimes these disks produce this and sometimes they don't. So there's a region close to the disk surface that requires close attention, and it is one of the main focuses of research at the moment. Two, there's then an acceleration region. This is the region where the model works best. As long as we can regard these magnetic field lines as stiff, so that they force the co-rotate of the flow, you can just simply calculate, very easily calculate what the flow speed of any particular particle along that field line will be as a function of its distance. And it will become faster and faster and faster, and eventually there will be a location where the speed starts exceeding the L-phase speed. or the density of the flow has something to do with the amount of mass it flows out. They specify the flow speed, and at some point, the density will start dropping off. Let's go, let's say, R squared or something of that order. So the magnetic field strength decreases with distance, and the density also decreases with distance, which you'll find that there will always be a point where the flow cannot be really tied to the field lines in the strict sense anymore, cannot co-rotate anymore, because the inertia of the mass becomes too large compared to the magnetic force. So there's an important surface here, which is called the outline surface. And beyond that outline surface, something else happens. Now, this is more difficult to draw. By the way, I'm showing you sort of a nice spherical cap, but it can have a very different geometry as well. There are a few lines sticking out for you. And beyond that, they don't co-rotate anymore, but the object below it still rotates. Now, field lines don't have ends. We can always trace back where a particular field line came from at the surface. And that basically means that they do this. Each of these field lines produces a spiral as the flow moves up. So imagine you have, I don't know if this is clear, basically you have the flow stops rotating because it expands, and by any momentum conservation, its rotation velocity goes down. At the same time as it's flowing out, there's something rotating below it that adds loops of magnetic field for every rotation around at the base. You get this spiral-shaped outflow, spiral-shaped magnetic field. But the outflow is like this with very little rotation left in it. Now, so this is the geometry that you expect in two dimensions, in the axisymmetric case. We will then find that there's now a problem, because I've shown this as sort of as a nice correlated outflow, but if you look at the mechanism that has been proposed here, it's not at all clear why that should be. It's clear that there might be an outflow, but there's no reason why it should be correlated in any particular reason. In particular, the model requires, the model clearly wouldn't work if I have field lines sticking vertically. You have to have some angle horizontally in order to get an acceleration. You have to allow the centrifugal force to pick up and accelerate the flow. So that means that the best kind of acceleration would take place like this, in which direction there is. We produce an outflow that's essentially the radial or in the equatorial plane instead of vertical along the axis. So there is then, in this model immediately, now this is not a problem anymore, let's say problem because it's been solved, but you still have a correlation problem. And this problem is essentially unsolved at the moment. There are a number of ideas. One of the simplest ideas, which turns out to be, I think, unsatisfactory, is the idea that the magnetic forces that do this. If you look at this particular field line here, which has a sort of a circular shape. If you look at that from the top, it would be a field line like this. Magnetic tension tries to close that field line on itself. So there's a magnetic tension force in this direction. And to some extent, this can actually provide a collimating force, so that the central parts of these outflows can be forced together by this pinching force of the magnetic tension. This works in two dimensions, axisymmetrically. Now, since axisymmetry is the only case that people can actually study, there's a strong bias in the literature of belief that this is what Colmage suggests. But there's a problem here, because if you look at the magnetic field, it's rounded like this, and suppose now that we are successful, you have a strongly correlated outflow. The outflow looks somewhere like this. Then inside it, we have all these magnetic field loops. We're now going to a plane co-moving with this low. What I see is regular field lines around myself, which sort of slowly in time expand because this collimation angle is narrow. Now, these kind of magnetic fields, highly bounded magnetic fields, are known to be violently unstable. By violently, I mean they go on an alphane crossing time. That's to say, this is the width of the jet, R, on the dynamical time scale. And this turns out to be short because the densities in here are low. It is really hard to see why this collimation force would survive for any length of time. And if it doesn't, then we don't have a good reason. Then the instability will already set in here, in this region, and there would not be much collimation left. It may be good enough for, say, 30 degrees or so, but the more narrow, the narrower you want your outflow to be, the harder it becomes to stabilize against these instabilities. So that's one of the problems. And there can be various suggestions. I won't go through them here. The cheap way out is to assume that there's something else that helps you. And it may well be that that's the real answer, that this flow itself didn't really collimate, and you have to have something else. Like, for example, if this happens inside a star with about to explode, like in the gamma ray burst model that's called collapsar model, then you have a whole environment of a star that can sort of force things together. Another possibility is that the disk itself is this, with our field lines here. Not just in this region with this magnetic correlation, but field lines here as well. And that those field lines, the external field lines, could sort of guide along these outflows. So I mentioned one connection with this here, this launching problem here. And there are possible other connections. So let's now go into the disk part of the program. The program is designed in such a way that we have both these aspects, what happens inside the accretion disk and in the outflow, with the idea that the connection between the two is of very topical interest. But of course, there are intrinsic problems in these disks as well, which we'll also try to address here. And some of them may or may not turn out to be of relevance for the outflow problem as well. So let me just take a slightly more general.
Before you do that, could you comment on the so-called Blanford-Snyder mechanism, which is another magnetic mechanism having the conductivity? Has that been, I take it that's been ruled out as a possible source of the
problem? No, completely. Blanford-Snyder is still, I think, very much alive. It's called, it extracts its energy from the rotating black hole by having magnetic fields produced elsewhere by the disk, presumably sort of passing through the hole. And then the dragging of inertial frames will wind up these magnetic field lines, and if there's mass on it, it will produce an outflow. Now, in the original formulation of Blanford and Nyack, the claim was that it produces an electron positron pair plasma. And that's, of course, interesting and quite possible, but not necessary, because there's mass flow means there's baryons everywhere. But if you don't have an accretion disk, you don't have any field, and there's not a process. So the presence of a disk is necessary, and then there are baryons around, so why not? Why those wouldn't flow out as well? Is another possibility. So you can have, I would say, it works, okay? It's just not entirely clear exactly under what conditions it's more important than the disk itself.
But it has a better shot at collimation, right?
Well, that's not so clear.
Excuse me, yeah. You show these magnetic lines that spiral, okay? But this should close at some point. How does it work?
It's sort of a non-issue because, how can I say this? It has to do with length scales. We're talking here about things which are very small compared to the environment in which the object is embedded. You follow these field lines out, you'll find that the field strength becomes very, very small. The alphane speeds are very small. The length scales become larger and larger. And the time scale for things to communicate are very long compared to what happens in time. So yes, there is a connection out there, But it happens on time scales which are very, very long, compared to the dynamics in here. So for that reason, you just ignore it. But of course, the flow goes out, it carries them in a few lines with it, and those end up in the environment, that's true.
Because, I mean, nice magnetic field should always have a closed line. I think it was connected sometimes with the stability problem you had before.
Yeah.
But anyway, okay, it is solved.
In MHD, this is essentially all we need to have in mind. We don't talk about electric fields occurring whatsoever. These field lines are vectored with the flow, and they just go wherever the flow goes. Okay, so I'm going to talk a bit about the disks. Disks themselves produce all sorts of challenges, but also opportunities.
Sorry, let me just ask a question. So, my memory is the only cases where we don't know that there are baryons are from the black holes. That in all the other cases, we know there are baryons in the shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And then in black holes,
both
micro quasars and AGN, it's ambiguous as to whether there are baryons there. And many would say there's no evidence of baryon.
Mm-hmm.
In all the other cases, we know there are baryons.
Yes.
You see an atomic feature or something on the point.
That's true, yeah.
Right.
Sort of absence of evidence.
Yeah.
The arguments for the presence of an electron positron plasma depend on interpretations of radio observations through a fairly lengthy sequence of steps, which may or may not convince. So I think it's still a bit open. But there's definitely the possibility that in some cases it's an electron positron outflow. Okay, disks. Now, many of you will know this already, I apologize, but just to get the nomenclature and things done, let's first look at possibilities. Accretion disks themselves would be interesting if you have them around a black hole, because the phenomena you see happening in these disks, like time-dependent X-rays or variations in the spectrum, might have something to do with general relativity. For example, if the disk is slightly inclined with respect to the axis of the rotation of the black hole, we'll have precession, and that might show up as a signature in the observations. It's one of the possibilities of probing general relativity close to the black hole. So far, that it is not quite clear whether this can actually be done, because we're not really sure what the various kinds of phenomena we see happening has any relation to general relativity. But it would, for example, be a possibility of measuring the spin of a black hole. It's one of the ultimate goals. We go now to disks. Disks have to do with viscosity. That's to say, we see that disks evolve. We see them for a certain length of time. For example, in X-ray binary, you see an outburst and the disk sort of decays on a time scale of days or weeks. So there's a time dependence in it, which gives an indication of how long it takes for this mass in the disk to go from the outer edge all the way in to the black hole, of the direct observation of evidence. Now, that raises a problem, because if you start with a certain amount of mass circling around an object, in the absence of external torque, its angular momentum cannot change. Now, the momentum cannot change, and it's on a Keplerian orbit, it cannot move in the radius either, and move in distance. So how can it be that this mass, that has a given amount of angular momentum, ends up on the hole? And the answer is seen by simple calculation, has been done already in the 50s. You start with a center of gravitating mass, with a gravitation potential gm over r. And for example, a small amount of mass that circulates, that rotates in circular orbits at a distance r0. And you suppose that this is ordinary gas, it has its own viscosity, kinematic viscosity mu, square centimeters per second, and you want to see how this evolves. Now, the rotation speed Keplerian rotation speed varies with distance. So there's a shear in this region, and viscosity will produce viscous stresses. Now, if the viscous stresses are allowed to act for a certain amount of time, will change the angular momentum of an orbit, a particle orbiting, and it will do this by, in this very simple, that the ring spreads. And this is because the rotation velocities are highest in the interior and lowest further out. So the stresses are in such a way that the angular momentum of these particles decrease. The angular momentum decreases, the particle moves in, because the angular momentum J, gamma times R squared, goes R to the 1/2. So in this way you can expect that the initial ring here will spread. So this is distance R, and this is say density in the disk, will spread like this. This is sort of the solution that come out. And if you follow this asymptotically, T to infinity, you'll find the following. The mass the angular momentum that I need, it turns out that almost all the mass creeps onto the hole, and a small amount of it moves out to infinity in this tail. At the same time, the angular momentum, almost all of it goes to infinity, and a small amount ends up here at the central lobe. So this is the way in which the disk solves its angular momentum problem, because it can spread, it can sort of distribute tasks, and the accretion of mass can go on at the expense of a very small amount of goes to infinity. And for this reason, this behaves as if it doesn't have any momentum constraint at all. The question now is, if you were to assign a viscosity to this ring, for example, ordinary molecular collisions, that you can calculate exactly how the viscosity will look like, how will this behave? Well, the only thing that this is generic, the only thing that the viscosity the amplitude of the viscosity states that viscosity does is it changes the time scale on which it happens. If you do this for your typical accretion disk in an X-ray binary, you'll find that the predicted time scale is, 10 to 14 orders of magnitude larger than what you actually observe. So it's clear that ordinary viscosity is not what does this. And you can then ask yourself what happens. And if you ask this question to a fluid dynamicist, the first thing he says is, okay, you have a shear flow, isn't it? What's your Reynolds number? You say, well, it's about 10 to the 14. And you say, oh, what's your problem? There will be turbulence. So let's assume that that's the case. What kind of turbulence do we expect? Okay, first we need to find the characteristic length scale. Well, the length of viscosity is the turbulence viscosity as a typical velocity times the typical length scale. Now, there's one particular length scale that comes in, and let's call it, where Cf squared is the sound speed squared, the isothermal sound speed, that disk has a certain temperature, and the subject of that temperature is now a length scale. At a certain position in the disk, you have a characteristic time scale, which is the orbital time scale, and that's together with the sound speed for the length scale. So this goes as t to the 1/2. At the same time, we can calculate the vertical extent of this disk because it has a certain temperature. It will be expanded in the vertical direction. There's a force of gravity on the part of above the disk that points inward. At the same time, there's a centrifugal force upward. And at the mid-plane of the disk, those cancel exactly, but not above the disk. There's a residual, which is proportional to the height above the disk. In this potential, this vertical potential, I can calculate what the distribution, the hydrostatic distribution of a gas at a certain temperature will be. And it will turn out that the scale height of the gas, which for constant gravity the proportion to temperature. In this case, because of the height dependence, the data scale height goes to the 1/2. In other words, we have here a length scale. Disk thickness goes as to the 1/2. We have another length scale here. And since there's no other relevant physics, these are the same. For this reason, the disk thickness up to a factor, numerical factor for the unity is just Cs over omega. Now this tells you that the thickness of this disk becomes smaller the lower the temperature. And this is one of the reasons why we actually believe that these disks are thin, because there's cooling. It takes a while for this gas to move from A to B, from the outer edge to the disk to the insides. And during that time, there's plenty of opportunity in most of these cases for gas to radiate away energy. Temperature is low, and therefore the disk is thin, and therefore it actually looks like the disk that we assumed from the beginning. Now this then immediately also causes a problem for turbulence, because the sound speed is low. Now for turbulence to exist, there must be connecting forces that allow eddies of a certain size to rotate around themselves. And the largest relevant speed we have here is the sound speed. But there is now a characteristic length on which a turbulent element can rotate. If I have a shear flow like this, and I want to produce an eddy inside it, there is a shear rate here, sigma, is r dr of omega, is minus 3/2 of omega. So the shear rate is of the same order as the particle frequency. If an eddy is rotating about itself here, then its velocity, eddy velocity, is sigma times L, which is the length scale L. And for L equals the characteristic length, which happens to be equal to H, this is of the order of the sound speed. So the eddies are supersonic if they're larger than the characteristic length, if they're larger than the thickness of the disk. Now that causes a problem, because an eddy that is supersonic, different parts of the disk don't communicate with each other. You can set it as an initial condition, but they'll fall apart because of different parts of it cannot communicate properly with each other. So this kind of rotating flow can exist only on scales of the order of disk thickness and smaller. And there's a question of exactly how they will operate, what sort of important things they can do. Joe Branco here is one of the main people studying that kind of flow. Now, if this is the case, then you can sort of estimate what the viscosity will be at this length scale times this velocity, and it turns out to be Cf squared. Mu turbulent is L times V, turbulent is L, is H times the sound speed, which is H squared times omega. With the turbulent viscosity we expect, let's say, because we're not checking certain about the scalings and dimensionless number here in front. This is then we call it an alpha viscosity. This is the natural unit of a viscosity if the disk is turbulent. And you can try to measure this coefficient from your observations, for example, of the decay of an outburst in a cataclysmic variable or a tribinary. And the answer is it's avoid unity. So it looks okay. This disk is turbulent, and it's just that this coefficient is avoiding unity, as you would expect from hydrodynamic theory. But as the physicists are not happy with this, because there's a real question whether this flow is actually turbulent. Now, of course, a fluid mechanic person will not see the problem. I will declare it is completely nuts if you think that there's a problem here. But astronomers like to see it this way. We know that the element increases with distance. And for this particular increase with distance, we have planetary orbits planetary orbits are very stable. Now, at low temperatures, pressure forces are small, and this entire disk, only particles in this disk, is flow on planetary orbits, Kepler orbits. So why would those be unstable? We know planetary orbits are very stable. And it's not entirely clear whether that argument is important or not. So this is, in fact, a subject of controversy at the moment. It has been a subject of controversy since the 60s. It was never a very violent controversy, because the astronomers were happy with their stability of planetary orbits, and the fluid mechanics didn't see the problems of little communication. And the status at the moment is we don't know really of any instability that will. Has not been any instability that's really proven to exist and produce the shear turbulence that you would expect from the Bortle experiments. And part of the reason for that, I think, is that you like to do this instability that will produce turbulence in a medium without boundaries. If this turbo here is going to be unstable, then it has to exist in a disk where the boundaries are very far away. If you have to wait for, say, information to propagate all the way to the boundaries and back, then by that time, this thing will be having sheared out of shape already, because it changes on the time scale of the orbital frequency here, which can be very, very short compared to the distance to the next boundary, right, by sound waves. So you'd like to have an instability that doesn't have boundaries in it, and all the experiments that one has in the laboratory of all these flows that are unstable always have these boundaries. And it's, I think it's becoming more and more clear in these laboratory cases that these boundaries are crucial for these instabilities. So here you don't have them, and the question arises, can there still be an instability? Now this is an open question at the moment. The astronomers typically bypass this problem because of a very fortunate development. It turns out magnetic fields are good. You put magnetic fields in this flow, you'll find turbulence developing. Now this could be seen only when the numerical simulations became good enough. Charles Gammy here is one of the people who is most actively involved in developing these models. But now that we have something that works, you add a little bit of magnetic field, the whole thing becomes unstable, and you get nice turbulence. But some will say, well, the hydrodynamics problem has been solved, but we don't need it anymore, we have magnetic field. So that's the present situation. It may happen that sometime in the future, some simulation will show hydrodynamic turbulence, and then the whole thing will have to be rethought. So let's look at a little bit at this magnetic turbulence. There's a name associated with it, it's called Magneto Rotational Instability. That's the name that applies to the instability that happens if you put a little bit of magnetic field in an accretion disk. Very low field strength. And you'll find that some instabilities start growing on the time scale, let's call it eta, or the and growth rate eta, which is of the order of the of phase speed divided by the disk thickness. Sorry, this is wrong. It goes at of the order of the shear rate. It grows as if it were a shear instability. In the limit of no dissipative effect, the growth rate of this instability is independent of the field strength. So it's a bit of a hybrid between a magnetic and a shear instability. It requires the presence of the magnetic field, because once the magnetic field is there, the growth rate is independent of it. This is a very funny situation, and this sort of anti-intuitive property of it is the reason why it has taken almost 50 years to realize that it actually happens and is important in environments like this. But once it happens, then it very quickly develops a stronger magnetic field, and that new, but final state of the magnetic field has probably very little to do with the initial instability. The initial instability is important because it shows you that there will always be a magnetic field produced, but the final state of this magnetic field is a very different issue. But you find in most simulations that I'm aware of, one finds that the length scale of this turbulence, magnetic turbulence, is of the order. The radial length scale and the radial direct is of the order to this thickness. And in the phi direction is maybe 10 times higher. Is that right? So, and it's a sort of a small scale kind of magnetic field. That's to say, people are looking for the possibility that you can also produce larger scale magnetic fields, but so far I think it's fair to say one has only seen magnetic fields which are turbulent and have this characteristic length scale of an accretion disk. Now, we have then, of course, as a result of this, we have no magnetic fields in this disk. And we know that for the jet production, we also need magnetic fields. So one of the obvious possibilities of study is to see if there's any kind of connection between them. Can we use these internally generated magnetic fields to produce an outflow, for example? So that's one of the active fields at the moment. It's not quite clear whether this is actually going to happen. But that's an issue. Another issue is that these magnetic fields in this disk will also penetrate into the atmosphere, even if they don't produce jets, there will be magnetic fields in the atmosphere. And there's a very rapid shearing up of these magnetic fields under a very time-dependent situation, which there is a lot of magnetic energy that comes out of the shear flow, dissipated not locally, but in the atmosphere, carried through the disk, through its atmosphere, dissipating there. That might be an important ingredient in producing the X-rays that one observes, one of the possible consequences. But that's where connection with observations of X-ray binaries are becoming important. So these are then some issues connected with both disks and jets. I just want to briefly mention a few other issues that we have added as focus themes in the program, which I haven't mentioned yet, because of various connections that we see. One of them is pulsar winds. A rapidly spinning neutron star, which formed after a supernova X-ray, shows you a magnetic field in it, like a pulsar in the Flat Nebula, will produce a strong outflow of energy. And we know that this is a strong magnetic outflow. From interpretation of the observations, we believe that it's an outflow of presumably a pair plasma with a Lorentz factor, bulk Lorentz factor, near of 1,000. And things happening in there, magnetic fields, instabilities in the magnetic fields, the plasma physics of these instabilities, is clearly of direct relevance also for other circumstances where there are these magnetic outflows. It's one of the reasons where there's a connection with something that at first sight looks rather different, namely pulsar wind. And then the second issue is a more generically the question how magnetic instabilities work if they have magnetic fields of this kind, for example. What kind of magnetic instabilities do we have? I mentioned the fact that if these instabilities are there, they will sort of destroy, think of the story of collimation that I have, so there's a relevance for the entire question of how we produce it yet. But this question of how these instabilities work, what will be the final result of such an instability, how much magnetic energy dissipates, what kind of forms of energy does this magnetic field transform into, can it produce radiation? Like we see, for example, in a gamma ray burst, it might be one of the reasons for seeing gamma rays produced by an outflow. These are questions that connect the sort of the microphysics of this magnetic instabilities with observational phenomena all the way from X-ray binaries to gamma ray bursts. So I could mention a few more things, but I think at this point it's good enough.
So are jets much less common than disks?
On the whole, they are certainly less common. There are certain kinds of disk objects that don't produce them at all. And in the cases where they are there, they're not there all the time. the particular cases are the X-ray binaries where jets seem to be intermittent in a particular critical stages of changes happening. I can't formulate it any more precisely because I don't think the observations are more precise than that.
But one doesn't think of that as sort of two different types of disks, those that produce jets.
But might actually be the case that the disk really has a quite different geometrical properties at the time when it produces the jets. It's in fact one of the suggestions, huh? That well, this goes outside what I've said so far, but one of the models for an X-ray binary is that there might be a region that is not really a thin disk at all, that close enough to the black hole, the disk is actually thick, meaning that the protons there, which have the mass in them, must be near their virial temperature, so they have 10 to 100 MeV temperature in here. The electrons cannot be at that temperature because they would immediately irradiate away their energy. Well, so there's a two-temperature plasma, protons much higher temperature than the electrons. But the entire mass configuration is now expanded, and that, as it turns out, if you have a magnetic field for it, helps greatly in this launching problem. How do we get mass on the field line? Well, I have an expanded atmosphere here. So this is one of the models that sort of makes a connection between phenomenology we see in X-rays and the presence of a jet, which is still quite important.
How much of the angular momentum in the disk is carried away by the jet? Is the jet carrying enough angular momentum to avoid introducing viscosity in the disk?
Well, that's one of the possibilities. It was already suggested in the 70s that this is a way in which we would have a quite different angular momentum balance in presence of the jet just through this. Maybe, in some cases, one of these open issues in fact. There's not a very direct reason for it. You could have mass flowing through this region and, you know, using a bit of outflow, depending on exactly how the conditions are, which may or may not be important for any other momentum source. There's no direct need for these to be directly connected, but they might happen in practice.
Question? My question has to do with the interpretation of astrophysical images.
Yeah?
It's well known in fluid dynamics that the distribution of material produced by a flow, particularly a time-dependent flow, can be considerably more complex than the dynamical flow that produced it. Because it's a result, the material is the result of evolution over a period of time. So I know that there's a tendency often to talk about astrophysical images casually, as if we are looking at the flow that produced what we see, but we aren't really. And I wondered if this difference between the flow and the distribution of material that is produced by the flow, I wonder if this difference is taken into account. It must be, I suppose, but I wondered.
Yeah, well, the case of these jets is relatively simple because they are really geometrically rather simple objects.
Yeah. But you did say they were time dependent.
Well, it's time dependent. What all we see is a snapshot at a particular time. And you're right. If you remember these knots coming out of H H to 12, they're not separated by certain distances. What that means for the flow is completely a matter of interpretation because you don't directly see the time evolution. So the interpretation that it has to do with the outflow being modulated is just one of the possibilities. And in general, if you see just an image, like for example the image of the Crab Nebula, I haven't shown it here, but there you see a very complicated geometry and you don't know what's in front and what's in the back, and the whole process of interpreting this is essentially impossible unless you have already a model in mind. You can do a forward modeling. I don't need a modeling and match it to your observations. It's basically what you're resorting to in the end.
Thank you.
I think that in an effort to try to have the granular people think about this for a minute, Gavin Flosso was here about a month ago and showed experiments of dropping a bead into a fluidized bed, sort of a sand bed which was not that well compacted. Of course, those of you who've seen the experiment, as the bead goes down, you create a hole in the medium, but then because of the pressure forces, you basically force the hole back out and you get a beautiful jet. coming right out of the sand. So, which is much, well, so it'd be interesting maybe for the two of these communities to talk with each other, especially in the context of the FLAPSAR model, where in this case, it's a little bit different. It's not that you've made a hole in the star from the outside in, but rather the jet has burrowed a hole. And I don't know, Andrew can maybe speak to it, whether anyone's thought about in the stellar case, the refilling of the hole from the size, that propagating, there's a propagating point there that, of course, accelerates out through the star. And that's the understanding of how you get jets, I assume, in liquids, but there's people here who know much more about that than I do. But there might be some overlap here on this pure hydrodynamic that I think that encourages these two groups to.
Yeah.
So you might want to have a joint session of jets and fluids and sand and stars.
Then we conclude that there's not much relationship. That's okay. Nice discussion. Yeah.
Well, it'll be okay.
I would like to make one comment to this problem of launching and acceleration. This pulsar mechanism, which produced pulsar wind and so on, is maybe applied also to this configuration. Because in rotating frame, you have a E equals zero, but in laboratory frame, you have a strong electrical field which accelerates particles as well as in the pulsar, and it may produce pure electronic jets, for example, if it's enough electrical force. So we had considered it many years ago, such a problem, and I'm surprised that it is not considered in the last.
Well, yes, people stay away from this because the Z-prom itself already has its unsolved problems, but I think most people will be aware that at low densities you'll have, you have to look at it as a plasma process, and especially in the pulsar wind case.
No, but electrical field is not never considered. It's pure.
Well,
I mean, if without electrical
field, if you're in a moving frame, then it's not clear that even in a pulsar wind that there's an electric field.
But we need further generator on the earth is
working. Yeah, but only if you go below the orbit of the field, then. Or if you need to go to the field.
That's good. One question.
There's always interesting new observations coming up, like for example, the jets coming out of a galactic black hole is a fairly recent development, about 10 years old. You see fairly faint radio sources. And it turns out they sometimes are there, sometimes not. So this is one of the new, very new observations. At the moment, one is really hoping to get more, better observations from larger baseline short wavelength interferometry. There's all sorts of attempts. OMA will be one of the great future projects. They're run by a large array of sub-millimeter telescopes, one hopes to probe even to the, really into the interior of a probe stellar disk, and there the possibility is real that one can actually see this connection between the disk and the place of the outcome.
Well, thanks for